Hey everybody, before the show gets started, a quick little announcement about something really fun happening this weekend. We're in October, so it's Oktoberfest right around the corner from the kitchen. We're talking about Capital Club 16, who is hosting a fantastic Oktoberfest this Friday. With us in studio, the elusive chef owner, Jake Wolf of Capital Club 16. What's up, man?
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here and fun to talk about this weekend's festivities.
Yeah, so of course, Capital Club 16, if you haven't been before, it is what, Bavarian Germanic style cuisine, is that fair to say?
Yeah, when we first opened up about 12 years ago, we launched it as American food with European influence, but my niche is German, Bavarian, Swabian cooking, so if anything, that is our niche, and we've been riding with that pretty good. And every year we do some seasonal features. We've got the Oktoberfest, we do wild game, we do the holiday goose roast around the holidays. So this is a fun time of year for us.
Well, my good buddy, Tim Vaughn, he texts me randomly and says, I have a gig. I'm a trombone player. I knew that. He didn't tell me that, but I knew he was a trombone player. And I'm playing at this Oktoberfest at Capital Club 16. Do you know it? I'm like, hell yeah, I know it. And so every year since, I've come to watch Tim perform in this amazing band. It's like polka band, if you will, or what do you call it? What kind of style of music is that?
Yeah, it fits in that polka oompa vein, but they start off with the classics.
Yeah.
The kind of beer garden classics, and then by the end of the night, they're rolling into the German pop tunes, whether it's 99 Red Balloons or something by the Police, and they put their oompa twist on it. So it's a ton of fun.
They got me up and sang a song a couple times at one point or another. I do believe I did a Journey song and Purple Rain at some point. So I can't promise that's going to happen again this weekend, but Tim's back in town, sleeping on my couch for the weekend, but I am super excited.
One super fun connection with the band is the band leader, Mosel Franzi, is actually Sylvester Schneider, who I worked for in 5 years up in the East Village, New York City. I worked at his German restaurant, and so we still keep this connection going, and he comes down with his bands and really brings down the roof.
Oh, yeah. These guys are super authentic. It's pretty awesome.
They're world-class musicians, and they just they bring the energy, and it's just something that it's hard to explain, so you got to come witness it.
Are you going to perform?
I'll perform in the kitchen.
I love it.
That's where they keep me.
Thanks again, man. And
thank you.
The details.
Yeah, so we're 16 West Martin Street. We're just right on the corner. The party's going to be start at 6 p.m. It's $10 at the door. We're not doing reservations. And we're going to serve traditional German food. And we got some great Bavarian beer on tap from Munich.
Look for an upcoming episode with Jake. We got to hear more about the Capital Club 16 and his rise up here in North Carolina. Join us this Friday night. And here comes the show.
This is the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast. Thank you for listening, subscribing, and hitting subscribe on your friend's phone without them knowing. Coming to you from the kitchen studios in downtown Raleigh. This episode is sponsored in part by Joe Van Gogh Coffee, serving the community from seed to cup, taking particular care at every step to honor the bean. And now, one's a salsa picante, the other's a kosher dill. It's Max Trujillo and Matthew Weiss.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast. I am your co-host, Max Trujillo.
And I am your co-host, Matthew Weiss. And we've been talking so much, giving so much attention, duly deserved, for the Fenton area, the newly opened Fenton area, with places like Mike Lee's M Sushi and Scott Crawford opening up Crawford Steakhouse, Crawford Brothers. But finally, we learn one of the chefs of the newly opened Coletta, and that is Chef Oscar Nappi. Welcome, Chef.
Thank you for having me. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. It's great to have you in, especially after we experienced your first opening and we got to imbibe on some cocktails and have a few snacks. Matt's wife critiqued your recipe development, you know. Well,
she and Chef were aligned on that critique.
That's right. And then, but owner of the whole place, Steve Palmer, and I were on the other side of it because the controversial part of it was gorgonzola
versus, yay or
versus
blue cheese.
Goat cheese.
Oh, goat cheese. Yeah. Do you go gorgonzola or goat cheese? Mr. Palmer and I were much more in favor of the gorgonzola, but you were edging towards goat. Is that what we're saying?
I don't fancy none of those cheese, but I realize and my life in kitchen and working in a restaurant, goat cheese actually pair well with the figs. So that's why we had to say, because some team member want to do the goat cheese with the pear pizza, the fig pizza, while the other ones want to do the gorgonzola. So you see goat cheese more everywhere compared to gorgonzola.
Yeah. Well, it was just funny. And because Sarah, who, yes, is quite the critic and a picky eater, I'll out her. She, when we got introduced to you, the first thing she said was like, something about, did you want to use the gorgonzola? And it was really funny because Chef was right there. And he was like, actually, we just had this controversy in the kitchen this morning.
She said, is that okay if I give you a critique?
I was like,
yes, please. Yep. That's going to help us to be better. She was like, it's about the fig pizza. And straight away, I told her, you're going to talk about the cheese on it.
You knew where she was going.
Yes.
That's, first of all, that is amazing that you remember that moment, because you must have met 500 people that night as of the opening. And I can't even remember who's going to be on the show next. So, Max, before we get more of this, can you tell me who's coming up on the show?
We have some great episodes coming up, like Lorema Coffee. We recently had a great stay out there in Charlotte, in the Queen City, to cover the President's Cup, which is fantastic. We spoke with local and national recognized writer Eric Ginsburg. We've got some great episodes coming up. By the way, if you haven't noticed, we're on camera now. We're doing a video show, a video podcast, so you can see our beautiful smiling faces. You can see what Chef Oscar Nappy looks like as opposed to just tasting his food. And so check it out. We have a YouTube channel. You can find all the links, whether you're on our website or any of our links in bio on Instagram. You can find everything there. So
yeah. Okay, so, Chef, beyond arguing about gorgonzola versus goat cheese, you have a pretty storied career as a chef, especially even in this area. You're born and raised in Paris, though.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, the beautiful French accent that you have.
Thank you.
And your family is of what origin?
So my family is originally from Ivory Coast, Africa.
Ivory Coast, okay.
Yes, so they come from Ivory Coast, and I got the chance to be born and grow in France because my grandfather, my dad, happened to do a war for the French. So therefore, that's how they got naturalized to be all French at the time.
Okay.
So that's when my family moved in France.
And so you went to culinary school in Paris, raised a Parisian. Talk to us about, first of all, what that was like, and then how your career brought you to North Carolina.
Well, I went 4 years in culinary school in Paris.
Mm-hmm.
It was hard, but you learn a lot. You have to do internship. You guys call it internship. We call it stage.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big part of the training for any job you're looking for to do, whatever you're going to be, engineer or you're going to be a nurse, you have to work in a real environment, in a real place in school.
I love that part about European culture, how it's so much more tactical education versus American education is so much more generalized and broad.
We just had that conversation about it. You, Felicia, Eric, all history majors, but it was really like a means to an end to just get that degree. Whereas, like, if you were a history major in France, I assume that, like, you would probably have to spend a couple years at a museum or at a library or some sort of archivist, like, location so that you could work in your field of study.
Yeah, you have tactical experience.
The reason behind it, and I think is a good reason, if you pay attention, you're in school, and I'm going to use a perfect example for myself, like learning English in France. I'm learning English. And I think then I got it. You know, we read the books, the teacher talk with us. I was like, yeah, I got the English.
Yeah, I can speak English, yeah.
I go to England, and I realize I don't know nothing.
Yeah.
I realize I'm lost. Like, what was I learning in school? So the way this worked, like my first 2 years in culinary school, I have to go 3 months in stage. So that's when I went to the Eiffel Tower in Jules Verne. That's when I was working over there.
Oh, you worked in the restaurant in the Eiffel Tower?
Yes, the Jules Verne. It's called Jules Verne. So that was my first internship. I was lucky to get there. Don't ask me how I get there, but I did get there. And then you start working in a real restaurant, and it's nothing to do with school. School is like right now. We relax, we got the book, we talk technical, you take your knife, you start cutting things. Then you hand up to the restaurant and they just give you 5, 6, 7 different tasks to do. You got all those things and then they just let you on your own. You need to go. You don't have the teacher look over you. You don't have your classmates and then you guys compare things. No, like you working and you have to get the speed. You have to remember everything you have to do. You have to set up your station. And then the time coming, you have to do lineup. After the lineup, you have to do service. It's like everything needs to be pressed on in your station. And it's like army. When it's time for service, 5 minutes before, everybody stand next to the station and the chef will come and pass.
Mm-hmm.
Make sure your shoes is all right, your uniform is good,
yeah.
Your knife is sharp, you got a curing board. Everything in the station is there. He tests your toes, he check everything you have to check, and then service is done. In school, everything's slower. So working in a real restaurant actually open your mind to what is going to be when you finish graduate. You got used to it. Now you go back to school, and you are way better than what you were learning at first. You can move, you can understand what the concept of work, being a restaurant or being a chef, you understand the concept easier. So when you finish graduate and you go to a restaurant, you already know what to look for.
Yeah. You hit the ground running, so to speak.
Exactly.
So with your first stage at Jules Verne, you did not, besides culinary cooking, work in a professional kitchen at all, even like something, you know, like
no.
We say like the equivalent of making pizzas or sandwiches or tacos. You were just went to culinary school and then straight to this high-end, very central, public-facing restaurant.
Yeah.
Wow. That's intense.
Yeah. I went in, I used the bathroom at Jules Verne in the Eiffel Tower.
You took the stairs or the elevator?
We took the elevator. Well, we went to the top of the Eiffel Tower, but while we were there, we were like, I was with my daughters and they had to go really bad and we're like, oh, let's creep in there.
So, you went to the top like Jules Verne, because after Jules Verne, you cannot go all the way to the top. It's the radio channel and it's the army.
We stopped at the where Jules Verne is, and then we got back out and we went to the elevator, and then we went to the very tippity top where we got the Moët Chandon, I believe is, or is it Moët?
Moët Chandon.
Is being poured at the champagne at the very tippity top, and so we did that, which was great. By the way, my pronunciation, of course, you corrected me immediately. That's probably how you felt when you're trying to speak English in England to English people after having a French, you know, only speaking French your whole life. When like as a sommelier learning about Bordeaux or learning about Loire or whatever, I'm saying these French words, you know, Châteauneuf du Pape or whatever. I say these words while I'm in France. I was in France for a month and we went all over the place. I'm trying to speak. And French people just look at me like, what are you? Just say it in English, please. Like, they're like, you trying to speak French is way worse than us just trying to understand English. Is that about right?
I think yes and no sometimes. If I take my example, like my wife, she's from here. So her and the parents, her and her mom specifically, every time that I will say an English word, they will correct me and tell me how to say the right way. So therefore, I was not shy to keep in speaking.
Yeah.
I was continue, and that actually was helping me. Then watch some people in a restaurant, let me say the wrong thing the wrong way and never correct me. So I keep in say the
doing
same
the wrong
thing wrong.
Yeah.
Exactly.
See, that's what Max is talking about, because your wife has an idea what you're saying, right? They're like, oh, you didn't say it correctly, but I know what you're saying. When you try to say French words to French people as an English-speaking person, they literally look at you as if you're speaking in an alien tongue.
Right, they don't even know.
I think I've told this story, but we were in France traveling, and I thought, let me call my contact who happened to be a French-speaking person and see if there's any chance that we could get a tour, because I had some connections at Cheval Blanc. And I say French words. I think, like, I have you commented on my pronunciation. I think I say them well. And so I'm on the phone and I say, is there any chance that we could get into Cheval Blanc today? And she, what? Cheval Blanc. You know Cheval Blanc. And then she's like, no. I said, this probably went on 7 times. And you know what I'm saying. Chateau Cheval Blanc, where they make wine, the famous producer of Saint-Emilion. And she just, like I'm speaking with two heads or an alien tongue. And so finally I like spelled it out in English.
Like, oh,
cheval blanc.
Yeah. And yeah, Felicia would sometimes then cut in and start speaking in French. And she actually can say a lot of things in French.
Yeah.
And then they'd go, oh, okay. But then I just thought it was just like some creepy French guy that just didn't want me to talk to him. And then she spoke and he's like, oh, mon chéri, okay, blah, blah, blah. I was like, I think there's a little bit of that going on in the subtext.
What say you, Oscar? Do you feel the same way that sometimes, especially growing up in Paris, like you kind of give the tourists a little bit of a hard time, especially the American tourists?
Actually, I don't. I didn't. I was actually fascinated to meet anybody who were speaking English, especially Americans. So,
because you were interested, like you wanted to learn English.
But what you guys do not know is that 99% of the French citizens in France want to come to America and love the American culture.
Mm-hmm. They just won't tell us that.
When I came here, I heard people say, oh, you guys don't like French people. I mean, you guys don't like American people. Nobody wants to come here. I was like, I mean, I live there. I'm from there. We want to come here. Like, who've all my childhood friends?
Yeah.
If I can show you my Facebook, they're like, oh, yeah, you the man. Like, you the president. You made it. You in America. You know, they're all excited because one of us coming to America, you made it for all of them, you know.
Oh,
so
nice.
We want to come here. So when I came here and people said the opposite, I correct them. I was like, no. Don't mix politics with people. The French citizen love America. They want to come here. Maybe French citizens do not like the American politics, like government politics.
Right.
Maybe they don't like, but that have nothing to do with them not liking the people and the country. We all want to come to America. We dream of that. That's like the dream for any French citizen.
So what you're saying is the French people can compartmentalize the government from the citizens and actually like people. What a refreshing thought.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like
we should learn how to do that.
You have to separate apples and oranges. My wife thought the same thing. Then I just told you guys, then French people didn't like American. I took her back in the day. She was my girlfriend. I took her to France because I wanted her to meet my family before I asked her hand to a family. I wanted my family to know her. So I took her to France with me. She went over there in the street. In any place we go, when people knew she was American, she can see the smile in their face, try to speak English with her, tell her about things. Like she said, what state she was from in California. They told her what was the rapper over there, what was the best city. She was like, oh, they know so much about America. As I told you, them French people love Americans. And now you actually can experience that yourself. So when you go back, you can tell your friend and your parent, and hey, by the way, we got the wrong thinking about French people. They really do love Americans.
But I only had positive things to say when I was in the countryside of France. Like when you get into the small, like more rural towns and all, I think everybody did really enjoy. It's not even so much that we were Americans. It's just they're like, oh, you're a traveler and you want to come here and spend money here. And you also are excited to experience the thing that we do every day. I think they appreciated showing off what they have to do.
They try to show you everything that town or that area of Paris are.
Right.
They want you to try everything. They want you to eat everything, drink everything, see everything.
Yeah. Oh yeah, the countryside of France is just there. It's a study in hospitality because it's just so welcoming. It's absolutely.
Oh, to someone that worked at the Eiffel Tower, is it true that you're not allowed to take pictures of the Eiffel Tower at night or when the lights are going off?
We do all the time.
I thought there was some rule that, like,
I don't know what you're talking about.
You weren't allowed to, like, when, you know, like, at certain times of the night, I think it's on the hour, right, where the Eiffel Tower will light up and, like,
it'll blink lights. There's a special, like, game of light which goes on in every hours, so people actually wait to be able to take the Eiffel Tower in picture, and then specifically after New Year's, you got the New Year's, you got the numbers, you got the letter, and then you got light go up and down and they flash in, they make like a song and a dance and people just record the whole thing. So I didn't hear about that. So last time I was there, we took a bunch of pictures of my wife.
Who knows what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, often that happens, but anyway. Yeah. Okay, so you married an American woman. It gives us maybe a little bit of insight into how you came to North Carolina. But your wife is from California. You're from Paris, and you ended up in North Carolina. How? Well, cooking at an Italian restaurant as a Frenchman.
We met in Winston-Salem,
okay,
North Carolina. She was in Salem College, a whole school of girls, and then I had a friend at the time who were in a school of art in Salem. And I end up going to the Salem town with one of my good friends at the time. And
like you were visiting America or you had moved here at this
point? No, I was already living in I was living in Kerry, working in Ann.
Ah, okay.
With Michael Chung. And then I went to Salem with him on a couple of days off. And then I went there. He was like, oh, I'm going to Salem. So I went with him. He introduced me to his friend. I liked the little town. It was nice and quiet. And there was some restaurant. They were looking for executive chef at the time. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. And then I end up living in Salem, moving over there. I met a friend. We was doing swing dancing class. And one of the girls he was practicing and dancing with, she was in Salem College. So I was cooking with them. We were good friends. We were doing a bunch of, you know, I was cooking for when they were doing a movie at the end of the years. They have 30-minute movie they were putting together because they were learning how to be producer and the movie writer. Oh, so they make a 30-minute movie. So I was cooking for 4 days for the whole team. They would hire me. I cook for the team.
Creative services is what they ironically call it on a movie
on
set.
On top of being friends with them, yeah. So I was doing that. And they had a wrapping party. The wrapping party is when they finish the movie. They have to wrap it, clean it, check the sun and everything. They call. So when that is done, one of the producers always had a party that he put together. That party was supposed to be the 14th of February.
Valentine's Day.
I was very busy at the restaurant. Then I told them, hey, it's weird that a bunch of single people and single guys and people in relation do that on the Valentine. Why don't we do the next day? Because I'm going to be really busy at the restaurant. They were like, okay, let's do the next day. So the next day was the 15th of February. And that's when I met Lauren, my wife now, because that girl was dancing with Alex, my friend. She invited my girlfriend because she didn't want to be alone. So she invited Lauren with her. And that's when me and Lauren met.
Nice. Okay. So, but how did you end up working at Kerry at On? Where did that come from?
Kerry On. So my cousin, my only relative from my family back in the day, was living in Raleigh.
Okay.
North Carolina. So when I come in U.S., I was in Austin, Texas first. Then I move in with him in Raleigh. So when I move in with him in Raleigh, I had a pastor friend. Do you guys know the French Corner Bakery?
French Corner Bakery.
French Corner Bakery in Durham. So the French Corner Bakery in Durham is owned by Benjamin Misawi, who's a French master baker.
Oh, this is the bakery right in the center of town.
Kind of. Not really in the center. It's close to the highway.
Okay.
So if you try to go to Costco in Durham,
okay,
it will be a couple of blocks beyond the Costco, close to the highway. So he knew Michael Chung. They worked together at Preston Wood Country Club.
Okay.
And he was like, Oscar, by the way, Chef Michael is looking for a really good sous chef. He opened this restaurant. He put me in touch with Chef Michael. I went and met Chef Michael. And I remember I was dressed all in white. I had white pants, white top, and then I always shaved my head. So I went over there. He looked at me from head to toe. It was like you're wearing white and all your clothes are clean and you just carry yourself with white. That means you're a clean person.
Yeah.
That's the first thing he told me. Then we talk, we sat down and me and him click. And he's been like a father figure to me. He's been a really good mentor. He teach me a lot. I work with him and we talk from time to time. And I actually helped him to open the first Element in Chapel Hill. When I came back with my wife from Europe, I helped him over there and we moved to California. But to come back to the reason how I ended up to Ann, it was because of that friend who put me in touch with Chef Michael.
Yeah.
So that's how I started to work in Ann with Chef Michael. And then when I went back, when my working visa was supposed to expire, that's when I went back to Europe with my wife now, who was my girlfriend, so I can introduce her to my family. We came back. We helped Michael open Element. Then we went to California because she was homesick. She wanted to go back to California. And then when we came back from California, you know, as a chef, I know many people say, oh, you're a French chef. You're just going to have like French background and the French culinary train. As a chef, I think that's the weakness for a chef to only know one culinary style.
No doubt.
And to only be good at one kind of cuisine. I always thought that a good chef should be able to cook multiple culinary style and be able to do it all. That's what I see myself. So I learned how to do Asian, I learned how to do sushi, Asian cuisine, I learned how to do Greek, I can do some different. So American is like French.
Yeah.
You burger for me, if I want to learn how to make burger, I'm not learning how to make burger in France. I want to learn how to make burger in America in a steakhouse because you guys are the number one in a burger. Like you want to learn how to play basketball, you learn with an American guy, you know you're going to get the right. So there's thing in the world.
Although nowadays you probably could learn basketball better in Europe.
Oh, controversial.
You guys have more technique. You guys have more technique and more, like you guys have variety of skill. Like we have variety of skill in soccer, like we call football. So I learn from the best, from whatever that country is really good at. And then I take that as my own skill, learn from the people, so that way I can be good at it.
Yeah.
So Italian cuisine.
Did you cook in California? When you were in California, were you cooking?
Yes, I was in Laguna Cliff, Marriott.
Oh, yeah.
By the Dana Point.
So in the south, you were in Southern California, out on the water.
We were in Southern California. We're living in Mission Viejo.
Oh, yeah.
And then
that's a really nice place to
that
be.
That resort, that whole area was really nice. That resort was really good. We were doing a lot. Like, we had a lot of events happen over there, then I'm still mind-blowing. We have a 6 million wedding happen over there when the gentleman bought the whole resort, all the rooms.
Oh, jeez.
All the guests was there. So
that's a party I would have liked to have been at.
I mean, in a life as well, people are lucky to be in a certain place. It's not because some of the place I end up, I didn't end up here because I went over there or applied to a date. I was just lucky to be in that area and a good fortune happened to me to be able to work with like amazing people or do something great or learn and have the chance to work there.
Yeah.
So I took all those skills with me and I just want to be a jack of all trades as a chef. I do Italian, of course, in culinary school. We learn some Italian recipe. We learn some Italian culinary because there's culinary style that worth knowing. And then everybody should know them, everybody should learn them and have experience with it. So you make one pasta, you know how to make pretty much 50% of the other pasta. You know, one recipe pasta, you can tweak it to get like a, you have one recipe, you can tweak that recipe to make 10 different pasta. So being a French chef and make Italian is no complicated.
Well, I want to hear more about the differences between France and Italy because I make the joke about how Italian cooking or French cooking is just Italian cooking with butter.
Oh,
and in Italy, it's substituted with olive oil. But before you clarify, you can deny, we're drinking some great coffee here.
Yeah, we are. Yeah, we're drinking, and we actually got this great organic Ethiopian Aricha blend from Joe Van Gogh, which we were drinking. It's fantastic. It's got flavor notes of blackberry jam, cocoa, grapefruit. This is like original origin type of coffee, and this is a light roast. This is something you shouldn't mess around with too much. Maybe just drink this black. Drink this without a bunch of cream and sugar in it. Just drink it nicely. This is fantastic, by the way, too, and I think that coffee is really kicking in because I'm like going crazy. But if you want to get your blend of coffee, go to jovango.com for more information or check them out at any of their local Joe Van Gogh locations all through the triangle from Hillsborough down here to Raleigh. So Joe Van Gogh.
And
by the way, and I know you're about to say something too, but I'm not completely wrong about the Eiffel Tower. Eiffel Tower, European law, in the European Union, there's copyright law that holds on for 70 years after the creator of whatever it is passes away. And when the man that created the Eiffel Tower, Pierre Bidot, passed away in 70 years later in 1993, the copyright went away. But the idea is that you're not really allowed to take pictures of things that you don't own and sell and distribute them. So like a professional artist couldn't take a picture of the Eiffel Tower and then sell and distribute those things because it was under copyright law. But that copyright law ended in 93. So now it's game on. You can do whatever you want. But there's a little bit of truth to what I said.
No, yeah. Like I said, that must be before because now everybody does it too. And, you know, there's loophole to that too. I can take a picture of you, my friend. We stand next to the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah.
I'm taking a picture of you while it's in the background.
Right.
I can take a selfie of me. So there's a couple of times. But before, yes.
When your friend's got his finger up and it looks like he's touching the top of the Eiffel Tower. Yeah, yeah. But anyhow, Matt, we were having some delicious wine recently. You were about to say something about...
Well, I was about to say that, we were drinking a Certico recently from a place called Ateca, which is about 20 miles north of Athens. And this is just it's steely, minerally driven, and just hearty white wine. But this is just one example of the great selection that you can get at Triangle Wine Company, strong friends of the show, and where I buy all my wine. And Max, you buy all your wine there too.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth, you will too. And Oscar, when you're not at the restaurant, maybe you will as well. So Triangle Wine Company has three locations. They're in Southern Pines, they're in Holly Springs, and their flagship in Cary. They have great tap rooms where if you don't want a wine, maybe you just go have a beer while you're shopping, and great service. And they're doing a lot of cool events. So check those out at trianglewineco.com. And don't forget to use the NCFB promo code if you're checking out there. Beer. To receive a nice little discount.
Well, we've been talking a lot about you, Oscar, and you're a fascinating person.
Thank you.
But we got to talk about Coletta. We got to talk about this place.
So you don't want to confirm my theory about Italian cooking versus French cooking?
Well, I think it leads into it because okay. You have a French chef that's cooking Italian food in theory, right? I mean, in very broad strokes. But Coletta is an Italian restaurant.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
It's an Italian restaurant, and the Coletta is traditionally red sauce pasta. We make our pasta from scratch in the house, and we make our pizza from scratch and roll by hand. We use a wood fire pizza oven.
Yeah. So did you just replace butter with olive oil to make all of your recipes? As Matt said, that's the definition of Italian food versus French food?
I think that's not 100% correct.
What?
How dare you?
Let's put it in perspective. Italians use a lot of extra virgin olive oil.
Yeah.
That is true. French people use a lot of butter.
Okay. So just like Max about the Eiffel Tower, it's founded in some truth.
We do use a lot of butter as well in Italian cooking as we're using a lot of oil in French cooking.
Fair.
Italian like to finish with the olive oil for the flavor. We use the butter to finish our sauce and our dish to get the butter flavor. So in a certain way, I should have...
You can see what I'm saying.
So, okay. Yeah. So basically, Matt's right.
Thank you.
Kind of.
Validated.
But give us a couple of examples of what someone could learn to have. Like you already mentioned the wood fire oven, so there's a lot of pizza coming out of the kitchens at Coletta.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, and would these be like in Neapolitan style, or what is the style of pizza that you're doing?
It will be more like Neapolitan, like we'll say, because they're not like our crust is not raised up. Is like flat, yeah. And they're cooking like in 2-3 minutes in a pizza oven.
Oh, right. Okay.
And you can't order a slice. You have to order a whole pie.
It's the whole pie, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so, we were there. We were having some great cocktails and a lot of great little snacks. We had some, you know, dishes that were running out there. But give us a couple of examples of some of the other food items that you're serving now.
One of our great items is the meatball.
The meatball. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so we had the meatball.
Anybody like go to Coletta need to try those meatball.
What's your meat blend?
We're using a ground pork and we're using a beef, CA beef.
Oh, yeah.
Certified Angus beef with the pork. And is something that we can have earlier around.
Yeah.
Those two to make them. I know some people sometimes ask us, do you guys use veal or lamb? And I always told them no, because there's a moment you won't be able to purchase them. So you're going to affect your recipe and you're going to affect the item. These are to go with two items that you can find nonstop to make sure that we're always going to have those meatballs made the same recipe, never change anything, never disappoint the guests.
Consistency, yeah.
Consistency.
I'm going to sound like an idiot when I say this, but I'm used to it. So I was walking by your restaurant. There was live jazz being played in the corner, and I walked over to check him out, and I was like, oh, this is really great. It's like a cool vibe. And then I was like, oh, what is that? Oh, my God, did I step in dog shit? I'm like, what is that? And there was this stink, and I'm like, what? And I looked at your host, and I go, do you smell that? You smell what I'm smelling? And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. I'm like, it's like, kind of smells like poop. And he's like, what? I go, poop. He's like, where? I'm like, over here. So he walks over with me. And then one of your servers walks over with me. And we're all smelling what I'm smelling. I go, don't you smell that? They go, that's the cheese platter, my friend. And I went, what? They said, you're smelling the cheese. You got some funky cheese on that cheese platter. Now, Can you speak a little bit? Like, what was I smelling that possibly would have given me that odor in the room?
I don't know. There were no French cheese, so there's no bad smell.
only French cheese makes
like
that
smell? Like a Stilton.
Yeah. Debris and the camembert can smell that, and I will believe you. But over there, we only use goat cheese. We use mozzarella. We use Parmesan or Pecorino cheese.
Yeah.
I mean,
Taleggio can get like that.
Yeah,
though.
You get
like
some funk off some Taleggio, but it was funny. But like, I know this sounds like I'm being negative or whatever, but the funniest part is that actually is probably some of the best cheese, like stuff that can really give off that kind of crazy aroma or odor, if you will. Like when you're at the table and it's in front of you, you don't smell it that way. It's like a different perspective. You're like, oh yeah, it smells great.
It smells something
but
like,
when you're just like wafting by, you're like, did someone just cut one? You're like, what the hell was that? I mean, what was the last time you went into like a cheese or like a cheese? What am I saying? Like a
cheese shop,
a cheese
fromagerie,
a fromagerie. Yeah,
fromagerie.
You go in there sometimes and you're like, whoa, what is happening in here? But no, so, I mean, if anything, that was like the authenticity is right there. You got some serious cheeses going on, but...
What?
It's like, thanks a lot.
This is just your...
Did you hit some?
Oh, then I ate all the cheese.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, it was delicious.
This is just Max's way to try to introduce some fart jokes, basically, into the podcast.
Man, you had to say a fart on a podcast.
Okay, what's your favorite Italian sauce to make?
Favorite? I think bolognese. I love the bolognese.
Mm. Okay.
The bolognese is one of my favorite ones to make. I love to make a linguine vongole as well with the pasta, the seafood pasta base and clam. Then you use to make that one is like I master that vongole sauce. I can make it right, and the bolognese, of course.
So bolognese, I love the bolognese, but I like it when it's an arrabbiata.
Arrabbiata sauce?
Yeah.
Like a spicy sauce?
A spicy bolognese. So it would be bolognese arrabbiata. Okay. What would you use for the heat in that, if you were doing that a coletta?
Alopo.
What is it?
Alopo.
Alopo.
Alopo
pepper.
Yeah, you can use that. I mean, that would be the right one to do to spike it up. Or you can use a chili flakes if you want, if you're a chili flakes person.
I like Alopo better, yeah.
Yeah.
And so would the meat grind be the same in the bolognese as you're using in the meatballs? Like pork and beef?
No, our meatball are just beef.
Okay.
We don't blend the meatball. The meatball is just beef.
Oh, I thought you said pork in the meatball.
Sorry.
The bolognese is
just beef,
yeah.
And then the meatball is the pork and beef.
Gotcha.
But the bolognese, we just want to keep it. There's a lot of people that can have our meatball because they don't eat pork.
Right.
And they know it's a blend, so the bolognese is just like beef.
That makes sense. You know, back in the day when I worked for Wolfgang Puck, he was known, his Grandma Puck's bolognese was made with chicken. It was ground chicken, and because we were in California and everybody was trying to be very
cool
healthy.
With that.
It was actually really good.
I'm sure.
Do you put a carrot? Do you put carrots in your bolognese?
Some people do, some people don't.
That sounds like you do. You do?
We do, yes.
Right. Now, he did too. He did like your base mirepoix and then added in the chicken or in this case, the ground beef.
We use the RoboCoupe to kind of like not puree and not chunky to get our mirepoix like really almost like brunoise with the RoboCoupe.
Oh, yeah.
So when we put it inside, they blend all the way around so you don't have those big chunks as you hit in sometimes a piece of carrot or celery was like very soft.
So one won't really notice a carrot in there because it will all break down. But the flavors are deep inside of the
sauce. Exactly. It will be a little hard to see it. You can notice a couple of like speck, but it's blend like very well.
You know, I make a bolognese all the time, but I have yet to do that. I'm going to do that next time. RoboCoupe, the mirepoix.
The mirepoix.
And then do you do that with the beef too, or you just throw the beef in, the ground beef?
So we have two ways to get the beef that small. Then you guys see when we make our bolognese, you use the mashed potato smasher. So as you cook the beef, you keep in smashing. Or if you want to use a different technique, you use a whisk.
Oh, yeah.
As you cook in and you keep in whisking, the meat get break down by the whisk. And it will be like smooth.
How many hours are you making that bolognese for?
6 hours minimum.
Okay, yeah. So that's also the key. Time is a good key for that.
Six hours minimum, slow cooking. So technically, we have to make the bolognese that the first thing we put on the stove on the morning when we get there, and that will be removed by 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock. But we start in the morning between 8 and 9.
Okay.
To make sure, like, so.
But that kitchen smells so good with that going.
So if you get their early reservation at Fenton at like 5:30, don't order the bolognese.
Wait till 7 o'clock. Yeah. Get it for dessert. Yeah.
No, we have bolognese, but we always have some. And then we make the next batch as we're getting low.
Because
we make
really
the batch, we leave it in the cooler for like overnight. And then the next day we portion them out and save them that
It's almost like you've got a starter, like a sourdough starter. Like you're continually, you have an endless bolognese. Like it's always adding to it and continually pressing through.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Crust of your pizza, is there any secret sauce to that? Like the crust, are you using like was it double zero flour. That's the traditional for a Neapolitan, right?
Yeah,
and it's just extreme high heat, a little bit of sauce. I understand you used to work with Amber Felizzi way back in the day too, right? That we discussed for a little moment. She was always, she says with her sauce, don't do anything to it. Like I think she just
the pizza sauce.
She just opens the can. She kind of whips, like blends it, and then that's it. I'm like, you don't put oregano or garlic or salt, pepper. She's like, no, just maybe some salt.
We put salt, but exactly, she's right. Don't do nothing crazy to it.
Yeah.
You get the GOP San Marzano tomato with like a certified San Marzano and protected. So we use that one.
They do all the good work in growing perfect tomatoes and canning them.
We open the can, we blend it. With a stick blender, salt, and that sauce is like, don't do nothing to it. You're going to add all the different garnish to make your pizza on the top of that sauce.
That's where the flavors come from.
Exactly. We use soppressata pizza. You guys know we're going to use the soppressata cured meat. You put on it. You use Italian sausages. You use mozzarella cheese. So all that's going to blend with that sauce. And because it's a firewood oven, and the firewood oven, our oven do not lose the heat since before we open, a week before we open, and since we've been open, the heat can never reach zero. You got a thermometer outside, and then even on the day off, I will go there and cook the oven by myself, put the wood inside to get fire going on.
It's like the JFK Memorial. Like the oven has never stopped.
No, you can never stop it.
Holy cow.
Yeah, before we leave the restaurant, the last thing we do is to add the wood inside the oven. When the wood catching fire, we close the door. I come in the morning, I open the door, there's still some charcoal there. Then I put the new wood right away. So it always stay above 400 every
and
single
the
time.
The reasoning for that? I mean, like what would happen if it went back to zero or back to like room temperature?
You talk about the crust of the pizza. Uh-huh. That is the secret for the crust of the pizza. The oven get all around temperature was like evening up.
Yeah.
So therefore what happened when you put your pizza inside, your pizza cook evenly all around the bottom to the top.
So even if the thermostat says 750 degrees, there might be pockets in there that are not if you've let it go down to room temperature and then back up.
If you let him go down, it won't be to that temperature right away. You're going to bring that. It's going to take a while to get there.
Yeah.
So what's going to happen, the top going to be done nice and cook and everything, but the bottom will not be,
be doughy.
Have that crust exactly.
And so you're not using gas assist wood fire ovens then, obviously.
It's just wood. Yes.
That's pretty awesome and old school. I mean, most people even today, just for the sake of, so they don't have to go in on their day off or whatever, and even just maybe for safety reasons, don't just go with complete wood fire burning ovens because there's so much work that has to go into it.
Right now, it looks like a lot, but not really. The restaurant will be open lunch and dinner. But because we just open, we only focus on doing dinner, and we have Sunday, Monday off, so the staff can recuperate.
You always got a guy that can throw a log on the...
Yeah. So what happened right now, it looks that way. Over then, when we open lunch and dinner, and soon, then every day, we are in the restaurant, so that won't affect anything. We just first person in, drop a wood.
This is the next thing I was going to ask you, because not all chefs are in shape. You're in like really good shape. Is that throwing the logs on the wood oven? How do you, when you're working as an executive chef, how do you stay
right over here?
Yeah, how do you stay in shape, man?
Many people keep ask me that. People ask me, do you go to the gym? I never went to the gym in my life.
Okay.
I work in a restaurant. What happens when you work in a restaurant? Restaurant work is very
demanding,
very physical. I don't know if you've seen the standing mixing bowl when we do our dough, the pizza dough, or we do the pasta dough. It's like huge. You have to carry that. The pot we have to carry. You're constantly moving, bending down to open the cooler, standing up, chop something. So if I pay attention to all the movement you do in kitchen, there's a lot of working, a lot of steps.
Yeah, you're like doing yoga that whole time.
It's like cardio, like up and down, cardio, up and down. So I'm sorry for some chefs.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
if you're a chef and then you're working in a restaurant, normally you shouldn't get away.
Right. It's when you start like just holding the clipboard and you have
or
everybody
just
do all
sit
the work.
Down or go to office. You're more than an office chef than a at in hand chef. That would be a different, that one way as well. People have different metabolism. I got a very good metabolism.
Yeah.
I can eat anything. I eat a lot of butter. I eat a lot of like sugar stuff. But my metabolism is so good, you burn everything quick. So I don't have time. So that is the other thing will help me as well.
Hmm. Never go to the gym, never throw weights around, even at home? You believe in Max?
I was in army 3 years. I was in army 3 years. So when I was in army, we were doing physical training, like running, pull up, because I have to jump from the plane with the parachute.
Yeah.
So I remember in my base, when you get to the canteen where you're going to eat for your lunch or breakfast, we had the metal bar on the top, and we have to do 100 pull-up to get inside to eat.
Oh, 100?
Yes, and when you come out, you have to do 100 pull-up.
I would have died.
Not everybody can do the 100 pull-up.
Yeah.
I'm just going to tell you right now, I think the maximum I see anybody do was 30.
Yeah.
My maximum is 23. And then you have to go eat. And when you finish eating everything, that's what you have to do for help you digest before you get out. Those pull-up was huge in our life, in my base, because jumping from a parachute and pull it one side of the parachute to guide where you're going to go, it was equivalent to do one pull-up.
Okay, so you needed to have that type of muscle memory jumping out of a plane
to guide your parachute.
So pull-ups were important.
So yeah, the most exercise I did was the most exercise I ever did in my life was like the pull-up, pretty much.
Yeah, but like I did a lot of exercise back in the day, and then this body happened.
Lemon juice and water.
All right.
Okay.
Well, there we go.
There you go. Oscar Nappy diet here. Butter, sugar, lemon juice, and water, and pull-ups.
And jump out of planes.
Yeah. Did you cook in the army at all, or you were there?
No.
Okay.
I end up with a chef. So you got different kind of like a grade in army. I end up with commandant chef.
Yeah.
But when I told people they hear chef, they were like, oh, you were cooking. No, it's like master chef.
Right,
chef
okay.
is chef in France.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But here, chef means like you work in the kitchen.
Right.
So when I told people I was in army, I was a commandant chef, people was also oh, you were cooking. No, was your grade. Then I got, it wasn't actually a chef, like cooking chef. I never cook or step foot in the kitchen in the army, not once.
Yeah. Maybe you guys, your command would have been better if you did, because I'm sure that, although it would be funny to see like, is the French army more focused on what they're feeding their soldiers than the Americans, just because you have this, you know, huge culinary background or history?
I mean, I'm not going to say the food was bad. The food was good. The food was really good.
Really? And
Yeah, the food was good. You have like different choice when you were going over there to eat between every breakfast. You have different choice of kind of breakfast. Cereal, toast, coffee, all the different things like normal people will have with their own choice.
Yeah.
So that was good. Like we were not forced to have one thing. So
like slop, what they say in American.
I have great experience. Now the officers eat way better than anybody. Our food was not bad.
Yeah.
But imagine the officer getting way better because the officer got chefs. We actually cook them in like in a restaurant.
Yeah, like they're at the chef's table.
Poached eggs.
The officer's
and
table.
Like, yeah, hollandaise.
they can do all of that.
Oh, man. Well, we got to get ourselves back to Coletta. Let's bring the wives again for a nice like romantic date night or so, because we didn't even get into the bar program, but the bar was beautiful. You guys were...
Thank you. You're
pumping out some delicious drinks. I may or may not have had a couple of Aperol spritzes that were perfect. and I highly recommend someone to go there. The whole Fenton area is really, I mean, it's blown up. Like, you've got great restaurants all around you and some retail. You've got that huge movie theater that's right next door to you. I think they boast the largest screen in North Carolina. So that's kind of fun if you want to see, you know, the next Marvel movie or whatever comes out. Go check that out. But yeah, why don't we take a break?
We'll yeah.
Come back. We're going to talk about some trending topics, some things happening in the news about the industry.
Yeah. And until then, go to Coletta. You will eat and drink extremely merrily.
Thanks for listening to the NC F&B podcast. And if you've stuck with us this long, review us on iTunes and remember, 5 stars are encouraged.